Chapter 17. Helena. 1. Mother of the Emperor Constantine, her zeal in the erection of the Holy Church. The bearer of these letters was no less illustrious a personage than the mother of the emperor, even she who was glorious in her offspring, whose piety was celebrated by all, she who brought forth that great luminary and nurtured him in piety. She did not shrink from the fatigue of the journey on account of her extreme old age, but undertook it a little before her death, which occurred in her 80th year, too. When the empress beheld the place where the Savior suffered, she immediately ordered the idolatrous temple, which had been there erected, 3, to be destroyed, and the very earth on which it stood to be removed. When the tomb, which had been so long concealed, was discovered, 3 crosses were seen buried near the Lord's sepulchre. All held it as certain that one of these crosses was that of our Lord Jesus Christ, and that the other 2 were those of the thieves who were crucified with him. Yet they could not discern to which of the 3 the body of the Lord had been brought nigh, and which had received the outpouring of his precious blood. But the wise and holy Macarius, the president of the city, resolved this question in the following manner. He caused a lady of rank, who had been long suffering from disease, to be touched by each of the crosses with earnest prayer, and thus discerned the virtue residing in that of the Savior. For the instant this cross was brought near the lady, it expelled the sore disease and made her whole. The mother of the emperor, on learning the accomplishment of her desire, gave orders that a portion of the nails should be inserted in the royal helmet, in order that the head of her son might be preserved from the darts of his enemies. 4. The other portion of the nails she ordered to be formed into the bridle of his horse, not only to ensure the safety of the emperor, but also to fulfill an ancient prophecy, for long before Zechariah, the prophet, had predicted that there shall be upon the bridles of the horses holiness, unto the Lord Almighty. 5. She had part of the cross of our Savior conveyed to the palace. 6. The rest was enclosed in a covering of silver, and committed to the care of the bishop of the city, whom she exhorted to preserve it carefully, in order that it might be transmitted uninjured to posterity. 7. She then sent everywhere for workmen and for materials, and caused the most spacious and most magnificent churches to be erected. It is unnecessary to describe their beauty and grandeur, for all the pious, if I may so speak, hasten thither and behold the magnificence of the buildings. 8. This celebrated and admirable empress performed another action worthy of being remembered. She assembled all the women who had vowed perpetual virginity, and placing them on couches, she herself fulfilled the duties of a handmaid, serving them with food, and handing them cups, and pouring out wine, and bringing a basin and pitcher, and pouring out water, to wash their hands. After performing these and other laudable actions, the empress returned to her son, and not long after, she joyfully entered upon the other and a better life, after having given her son much pious advice, and her fervent parting blessing. All to her death, those honors were rendered to her memory which her steadfast and zealous service to God deserved. 9. Chapter 18. The Unlawful Translation of Eusebius, Bishop of Nicomedia. The Arian party did not desist from their evil machinations. They had only signed the confession of faith for the purpose of disguising themselves in sheepskins, while they were acting the part of wolves. The holy Alexander of Byzantium, for the city was not yet called Constantinople, who by his prayer had pierced Arius to the heart, had, at the period to which we are referring, been translated to a better life. Eusebius, the propagator of impiety, little regarding the definition which, only a short time previously, he with the other bishops had agreed upon, without delay quitted Nicomedia, and seized upon the see of Constantinople, in direct violation of that canon, 1, which prohibits bishops and presbyters from being translated from one city to another. But that those who carry their infatuation so far as to deny the divinity of the only begotten Son of God should likewise violate the other laws cannot excite surprise. Nor was this the first occasion that he made this innovation, for, having been originally entrusted with the See of Berytus, he leapt from thence to Nicomedia, whence he was expelled by the synod on account of his manifest impiety, as was likewise Dionysius, Bishop of Nicaea. This is related a second time in the letters of the Emperor Constantine, and I shall here insert the close of the letter which he wrote to the Nicomedians. Chapter 19. Epistle of the Emperor Constantine against Eusebius Antioni, addressed to the Nicomedians. Who has taught these doctrines to the innocent multitude? It is manifestly Eusebius, the co-operator in the cruelty of the tyrants, for that he was the creature, 1, of the tyrant has been clearly shown, and, indeed, is proved by the slaughter of the bishops, and by the fact that these victims were true bishops. The relentless persecution of the Christians proclaims this fact aloud. I shall not here say anything of the insults directed against me, by which the conspiracies of the opposite faction were mainly carried out, but he went so far as to send spies to watch me, and scarcely refrained from raising troops in aid of the tyrant. Let not anyone imagine that I allege what I am not prepared to prove. I am in possession of clear evidence, for I have caused the bishops and presbyters belonging to his following to be seized. But I pass over all these facts. I only mention them for the purpose of making these persons ashamed of their conduct, and not from any feeling of resentment. There is one thing I fear, one thing which causes me anxiety, and that is to see you charged as accomplices, for you are influenced by the doctrines of Eusebius, and have thus been led away from the truth. But your cure will be speedy, if, after obtaining a bishop who holds pure and faithful doctrines, you will but look unto God. This depends upon you alone, and you would, no doubt, have thus acted long ago, had not the aforesaid Eusebius come here, strongly supported by those then in power, and overturned all discipline. As it is necessary to say something more about Eusebius, your patience will remember that a council was held in the city of Nicaea, at which, in obedience to my conscience, I was present, being actuated by no other motive than the desire of producing unanimity among all, and before all else of proving and dispelling the mischief which originated from the infatuation of Arius of Alexandria, and was straightway strengthened by the absurd and pernicious machinations of Eusebius. But, beloved and much honored brethren, you know not how earnestly and how disgracefully Eusebius, although convicted by the testimony of his own conscience, persevered in the support of the false doctrines which had been universally condemned. He secretly sent persons to meet a petition on his behalf, and personally entreated my assistance in preventing his being ejected from his bishopric, although his crimes had been fully detected. God, who, I trust, will continue his goodness towards you and towards me, is witness to the truth of what I say. I was then myself deluded and deceived by Eusebius, as you shall well know. In everything he acted according to his own desire, his mind being full of every kind of secret evil. Omitting the relation of the rest of his misdeeds, it is well that you should be informed of the crime which he lately perpetrated in concert with Deioni, the accomplice of his folly. I had sent orders for the apprehension of certain individuals in Alexandria who had deserted our faith, and by whose means the firebrand of dissension was kindled. But these good gentlemen, forsooth, bishops, whom, by the clemency of the council, I had reserved for penitence, not only received them under their protection, but also participated in their evil deeds. Hence I came to the determination to punish these ungrateful men, by apprehending and banishing them to some far distant region. It is now your duty to look unto God with that same faith which it is clear that you have ever held, and in which it is fitting you should abide. So let us have cause of rejoicing in the appointment of pure, orthodox, and beneficent bishops. If anyone should make mention of those destroyers, or presume to speak in their praise, let him know that his audacity will be repressed by the authority which has been committed to me as the servant of God. May God preserve you, beloved brethren. The above-mentioned bishops were then deposed and banished. Amphion, 2, was entrusted with the church of Nicomedia, and Crestus, 3, with that of Nicaea. But the exiled bishops, employing their customary artifices, abused the benevolence of the emperor, renewed the previous contests, and regained their former power. Chapter 20. The artful machinations of Eusebius and his followers against the holy Eustathius, bishop of Antioch. Eusebius, as I have already stated, seized the diocese of Constantinople by force, and thus having acquired great power in that city, frequently visiting and holding familiar intercourse with the emperor, he gained confidence and formed plots against those who were foremost in the support of the truth. He at first reigned a desire of going to Jerusalem to see the celebrated edifices there erected, and the emperor, who was deceived by his flattery, allowed him to set out with the utmost honor, providing him with carriages and the rest of his equipage and retinue. Teoni, bishop of Nicaea, who, as we have before said, was his accomplice in his evil designs, traveled with him. When they arrived at Antioch, they put on the mask of friendship, and were received with the utmost deference. Oestetes, the great champion of the faith, treated them with fraternal kindness. When they arrived at the holy places, they had an interview with those who were of the same opinions as themselves, namely, Eusebius, bishop of Caesarea, Patrophilus, bishop of Scythopolis, Aetius, bishop of Lydda, Theodotuk, bishop of Laodicea, and others, who had imbibed the Arian sentiments. They made known the plot they had hatched to them, and went with them to Antioch. The pretext for their journey was that due honor might be rendered Eusebius, but their real motive was their war against religion. They bribed a low woman, who made a traffic of her beauty, to sell them her tongue, and then repaired to the council, and when all the spectators had been ordered to retire, they introduced the wretched woman. She held a babe in her arms, of which she loudly and impudently affirmed that Eustathius was the father. Eustathius, conscious of his innocence, asked her whether she could bring forward any witness to prove what she had advanced. She replied that she could not, yet these equitable judges admitted her to oath, although it is said in the law that at the mouth of two or three witnesses shall the matter be established. 1. And the apostle says, against an elder receive not any accusation, but before two or three witnesses. 2. But they despised these divine laws, and admitted the accusation against this great man, without any witnesses. When the woman had again declared upon oath that Eustathius was the father of the babe, these truth-loving judges condemned him as an adulterer. When the other bishops, who upheld the apostolical doctrines, being ignorant of all these intrigues, openly opposed the sentence, and advised Eustathius not to submit to it, the originators of the plot promptly repaired to the emperor, and endeavored to persuade him that the accusation was true, and the sentence of deposition just, and they succeeded in obtaining the banishment of this champion of piety and chastity, as an adulterer and a tyrant. He was conducted across Thrace to a city of Illyricum. 3. Chapter 21. Bishops of heretical opinions ordained in Antioch after the banishment of Saint Eustathius. 1. Eulalius was first consecrated in place of Eustathius, but Eulalius surviving his elevation only a short period, it was intended that Eusebius of Palestine should be translated to this bishopric. Eusebius, however, refused the appointment, and the emperor forbade its being conferred on him. Next Euphronius was put forward, who also dying, after a lapse of only 1 year and a few months, the see was conferred on Flaccillus. 2. All these bishops secretly clung to the Arian heresy. Hence it was that most of those individuals, whether of the clergy or of the laity, who valued the true religion, left the churches and formed assemblies among themselves. They were called Eustathians, since it was after the banishment of Eustathius that they began to hold their meetings. The wretched woman above mentioned was soon after attacked by a severe and protracted illness, and then avowed the imposture in which she had been engaged, and made known the whole plot, not only to two or three, but to a very large number of priests. She confessed that she had been bribed to bring this false and impudent charge, but yet that her oath was not altogether false, as a certain Eustathius, a coppersmith, was the father of the babe. Such were some of the crimes perpetrated in Antioch by this most excellent faction. Chapter 22. Conversion of the Indians. 1. At this period, the light of the knowledge of God was for the first time shed upon India. The courage and the piety of the emperor had become celebrated throughout the world, and the barbarians, having learned by experience to choose peace rather than war, were able to enjoy intercourse with one another without fear. Many persons, Therefore, set out on long journeys, some for the desire of making discoveries, others from a spirit of commercial enterprise. About this period a native of Tyre, too, acquainted with Greek philosophy, desiring to penetrate into the interior of India, set off for this purpose with his two young nephews. When he had accomplished the object of his wishes, he embarked for his own country, the ship being compelled to put into land in order to obtain a fresh supply of water. The barbarians fell upon her, drowned some of the crew, and took the others prisoners. The uncle was among the number of those who were killed, and the lads were conducted to the king. The name of the one was Aedesius, and of the other Frumentius. The king of the country, in course of time, perceiving their intelligence, promoted them to the superintendence of his household. If anyone should doubt the truth of this account, let him recall to mind the history of Joseph in the kingdom of Egypt, and also the history of Daniel, and of the three champions of the truth, who, from being captives, became princes of Babylon. The king died, but these young men remained with his son, and were advanced to still greater power. As they had been brought up in the true religion, they exhorted the merchants who visited the country to assemble, according to the custom of Romans, 3, to take part in the divine liturgy. After a considerable time they solicited the king to reward their services by permitting them to return to their own country. They obtained his permission and safely reached Roman territory. Aedesius directed his course towards Tyre, but Frumentius, whose religious zeal was greater than the natural feeling of affection for his relatives, proceeded to Alexandria, and informed the bishop of that city that the Indians were deeply anxious to obtain spiritual light. Athanasius then held the rudder of that church. He heard the story, and then who, said he, better than you yourself can scatter the mists of ignorance, and introduce among this people the light of divine preaching? After having said this, he conferred upon him the episcopal dignity, and sent him to the spiritual culture of that nation. The newly ordained bishop left this country, caring nothing for the mighty ocean, and returned to the untilled ground of his work. There, having the grace of God to labor with him, he cheerfully and successfully played the husbandman, catching those who sought to gainsay his words by works of apostolic wonder, and thus, by these marvels, confirming his teaching, he continued each day to take many souls alive. 4. Chapter 23, Conversion of the Iberians, 1. Frumentius thus led the Indians to the knowledge of God. Iberia, about the same time, was guided into the way of truth by a captive woman, too. She continued instant in prayer, allowing herself no softer bed than a sack spread upon the ground, and accounted fasting her highest luxury. This austerity was rewarded by gifts similar to those of the apostles. The barbarians, who were ignorant of medicine, were accustomed, when attacked by disease, to go to one another's houses, in order to ask those who had suffered in a similar way, and had got well, by what means they had been cured. In accordance with this custom, a mother, who had a sick child, repaired to this admirable woman, to inquire if she knew of any cure for the disease. The latter took the child, placed it upon her bed, and prayed to the Creator of the world to be propitious to it, and cure the disease. He heard her prayer, and made it whole. This extraordinary woman hence obtained great celebrity, and the queen, who was suffering from a severe disease, hearing of her by report, sent for her. The captive held herself in very low estimation, and would not accept the invitation of the queen. But the queen, forced by her sore need, and careless of her royal dignity, herself ran to the captive. The latter made the queen lie down upon her mean bed, and once again applied to her disease the efficacious remedy of prayer. The queen was healed, and offered as rewards for her cure, gold, silver, tunics, and mantles, and such gifts as she thought worthy of possession, and such as royal munificence should bestow. The holy woman told her that she did not want any of these, but that she would deem her greatest reward to be the queen's knowledge of true religion. She then, as far as in her lay, explained the divine doctrines, and exhorted her to erect a church in honor of Christ, who had made her whole. The queen then returned to the palace, and excited the admiration of her consort by the suddenness of her cure. She then made known to him the power of that God, whom the captive adored, and besought him to acknowledge the one only God, and to erect a church to him, and to lead all the nation to worship him. The king was greatly delighted with the miracle which had been performed upon the queen, but he would not consent to erect a church. A short time after he went out hunting, and the loving Lord made a prayer of him as he did of Paul, for sudden darkness enveloped him, and forbade him to move from the spot, while those who were hunting with him enjoyed the customary sunlight, and he alone was bound with the fetters of blindness. In his perplexity he found a way of escape, for calling to mind his former unbelief, he implored the help of the God, of the captive woman, and immediately the darkness was dispelled. He then went to the marvelous captive, and asked her to show him how a church ought to be built. He who once filled Bezalel with architectural skill, graciously enabled this woman to devise the plan of a church. The woman set about the plan, and men began to dig and build. When the edifice was completed, the roof put on, and everything supplied except the priests, this admirable woman found means to obtain these also. For she persuaded the king to send an embassy to the Roman emperor asking for teachers of religion. The king accordingly dispatched an embassy for the purpose. The emperor Constantine, who was warmly attached to the cause of religion, when informed of the purport of the embassy, gladly welcomed the ambassadors, and selected a bishop endowed with great faith, wisdom, and virtue, and presenting him with many gifts, sent him to the Iberians, that he might make known to them the true God. Not content with having granted the requests of the Iberians, he of his own accord undertook the protection of the Christians in Persia, for, learning that they were persecuted by the heathens, and that their king himself, a slave to error, was contriving various cunning plots for their destruction, he wrote to him, entreating him to embrace the Christian religion himself, as well as to honor its professors. His own letter will render his earnestness in the cause the plainer. Chapter 24. Letter written by the Emperor Constantine to Sapor, 1. The King of Persia, respecting the Christians. In protecting the holy faith I enjoy the light of truth, and by following the light of truth I attain to fuller knowledge of the faith. Therefore, as facts prove, I recognize that most holy worship as teaching the knowledge of the most holy God. This service I profess, with the power of this God, for my ally. Beginning at the furthest boundaries of the ocean, I have, one after another, quickened every part of the world with hope. Now all the peoples once enslaved by many tyrants, warned by their daily miseries, and almost extinct, have been kindled to fresh life, by receiving the protection of the state. The God I reverence is he whose emblem my dedicated troops bear on their shoulders, marching whithersoever the cause of justice leads them, and rewarding me by their splendid victories. I confess that I reverence this God, with eternal remembrance. Him, who dwelleth in the highest heavens, I contemplate with pure and unpolluted mind. On him I call on bended knees, shunning all abominable blood, all unseemly and ill-omened odors, all fire of incantation, too, and all pollution by which unlawful and shameful error has destroyed whole nations, and hurled them down to hell. God does not permit those gifts which, in his beneficent providence, he has bestowed upon men for the supply of their wants, to be perverted according to every man's desire. He only requires of men a pure mind, and a spotless soul, and by these he weighs their deeds of virtue and piety. He is pleased with gentleness, 3, and modesty. He loves the meek, 4, and hates those who excite contentions. He loves faith, chastises unbelief, he breaks all power of boasting, 5, and punishes the insolence of the proud, 6, men exalted with pride he utterly overthrows, and rewards the humble, 7, and the patient, 8, according to their deserts. Of a just sovereignty he maketh much, strengthens it by his aid, and guards the counsels of princes, with the blessing of peace. I know that I am not in error, my brother, when I confess that this God is the ruler, and the father, of all men, a truth which many who preceded me upon the imperial throne were so deluded by error, as to attempt to deny. But their end was so dreadful that they have become a fearful warning to all mankind, to deter others from similar iniquity. 9. Of these I count that man one whom the wrath of God, like a thunderbolt, drove hence into your country, and who made notorious the memorial of his shame which exists in your own land. 10. Indeed, it appears to have been well ordered that the age in which we live should be distinguished by the open and manifest punishments inflicted on such persons. I myself have witnessed the end of those who have persecuted the people of God by unlawful edicts. Hence it is that I more especially thank God for having now, by His special providence, restored peace to those who observe His law, in which they exult and rejoice. I am led to expect future happiness and security whenever God in His goodness unites all men in the exercise of the one pure and true religion. You may therefore well understand how exceedingly I rejoice to hear that the finest provinces of Persia were adorned abundantly with men of this class, I mean Christians, for it is of them I am speaking. All then is well with you and with them, for you will have the Lord of all merciful and beneficent to you. Since then you are so mighty and so pious, I commend the Christians to your care, and leave them in your protection. Treat them, I beseech you, with the affection that befits your goodness. Your fidelity in this respect will confer on yourself and on us inexpressible benefits. This excellent emperor felt so much solicitude for all who had embraced the true religion, that he not only watched over those who were his own subjects, but also over the subjects of other sovereigns. For this reason he was blessed with a special protection of God, so that although he held the reins of the whole of Europe, and of Africa, and the greater part of Asia, his subjects were all well disposed to his rule, and obedient to his government. For in nations submitted to his sway, some by voluntary submission, others overcome in war, trophies were everywhere erected, and the emperor was styled victorious. The praises of Constantine have, however, been proclaimed by many other writers. We must resume the thread of our history. This emperor, who deserves the highest fame, devoted his whole mind to matters worthy of the apostles, while men, who had been admitted to the sacerdotal dignity, not only neglected to edify the church, but endeavored to uproot it from the very foundations. They invented all manner of false accusations against those who governed the church in accordance with the doctrines taught by the apostles, and did their best to depose and banish them. Their envy was not satisfied by the infamous falsehood which they had invented against Eustathius, but they had recourse to every artifice to effect the overthrow of another great bulwark of religion. These tragic occurrences I shall now relate as concisely as possible. Chapter 25, An Account of the Plot Formed Against the Holy Athanasius. Alexander, that admirable bishop, who had successfully withstood the blasphemies of Arius, died 5 months after the Council of Nicaea, and was succeeded in the episcopate of the Church of Alexandria by Athanasius. Trained from his youth in sacred studies, Athanasius had attracted general admiration in each ecclesiastical office that he filled. He had, at the general council, so defended the doctrines of the apostles, that while he won the approbation of all the champions of the truth, its opponents learned to look on their antagonist as a personal foe and public enemy. He had attended the council as one of the retinue of Alexander, then a very young man, although he was the principal deacon. 1. When those who had denied the only begotten Son of God heard that the helm of the Church of Alexandria had been entrusted to his hands, knowing, as they did by experience, his zeal for the truth, they thought that his rule would prove the destruction of their authority. They, therefore, resorted to the following machinations against him. In order to avert suspicion, they bribed some of the adherents of Meletius, who, although deposed by the Council of Nicaea, had persevered in exciting commotions in the Thebaid and in the adjacent part of Egypt, and persuaded them to go to the emperor and to accuse Athanasius of levying a tax upon Egypt, too, and giving the gold collected to a certain man who was preparing to usurp the imperial power. 3. The emperor being deceived by this story, Athanasius was brought to Constantinople. Upon his arrival he proved that the accusation was false, and had the charge given him by God restored to him. This is shown by a letter from the emperor to the Church of Alexandria, of which I shall transcribe only the concluding paragraph. A portion of the letter from the Emperor Constantine to the Alexandrians. Believe me, my brethren, the wicked men were unable to effect anything against your bishop, They surely could have had no other design than to waste our time, and to leave themselves no place for repentance in this life. Do you, therefore, help yourselves, and love that which wins your love for, and exert all your power in the expulsion of those who wish to destroy your concord. Look unto God, and love one another. I joyfully welcomed Athanasius your bishop, and I have conversed with him as with one whom I know to be a man of God. Chapter 26. Another plot against Athanasius. The calumniators of Athanasius, however, did not desist from their attempts. On the contrary, they devised so bold a fiction against him that it surpassed every invention of the ancient writers of the tragic or comic stage. They again bribed individuals of the same party, and brought them before the emperor, vociferously accusing that champion of virtue of many abominable crimes. The leaders of the party were Eusebius, Theonii, and Theodorus, bishop of Perinthus, a city now called Heraclea. 1. After having accused Athanasius of crimes which they described as too shocking to be tolerated, or even listened to, they persuaded the emperor to convene a council at Caesarea in Palestine, where Athanasius had many enemies, and to command that his cause should be there tried. The emperor, utterly ignorant of the plot that had been devised, was persuaded by them to give the required order. But the holy Athanasius, well aware of the malevolence of those who were to try him, refused to appear at the council. This served as a pretext to those who opposed the truth to criminate him still further, and they accused him before the emperor of contumacy and arrogance. Nor were their hopes altogether frustrated, for the emperor, although exceedingly forbearing, became exasperated by their representations, and wrote to him in an angry manner, commanding him to repair to Tyre. Here the council was ordered to assemble, from the suspicion, as I think, that Athanasius had an apprehension of Caesarea on account of its bishop. The emperor wrote also to the council in a style consistent with his devoted piety. His letter is as follows. Chapter 27. Epistle of the Emperor Constantine to the Council of Tyre. 1. Constantinus Augustus to the Holy Council assembled in Tyre. In the general prosperity which distinguishes the present time, it seems right that the Catholic Church should likewise be exempt from trouble, and that the servants of Christ should be freed from every reproach. But certain individuals instigated by the mad desire of contention, not to say leading a life unworthy of their profession, are endeavoring to throw all into disorder. This appears to me to be the greatest of all possible calamities. I beseech you, therefore, in post haste, as the phrase goes, to assemble together, without any delay, in formal synod, so that you may support those who require your assistance. Heal the brethren who are in danger, restore unanimity to the divided members, and rectify the disorders of the church, while time permits, and thus restore to those great provinces the harmony which, alas, the arrogance of a few men has destroyed. I believe everyone would admit that you could not perform anything so pleasing in the sight of God, so surpassing all my prayers as well as your own, or so conducive to your own reputation, as to restore peace. Do not ye therefore delay, but when you have come together with all that sincerity and fidelity which our Savior demands of all his servants, almost in words that we can hear, endeavor with redoubled eagerness to put a fitting end to these dissensions. Nothing shall be omitted on my part to further the interests of our religion. I have done all that you recommended in your letters. I have sent to those bishops whom you specified, directing them to repair to the council for the purpose of deliberating with you upon ecclesiastical matters. I have also sent Dionysius, too, a man of consular rank, to counsel those who are to sit in synod with you, and to be himself an eyewitness of your proceedings, and particularly of the order and regularity that is maintained. If anyone should dare on the present occasion also to disobey our command, and refuse to come to the council, which, however, I do not anticipate, an officer will be dispatched immediately to send him into banishment by imperial order, that he may learn not to oppose the decrees enacted by the emperor for the support of truth. All that now devolves upon your holinesses is to decide with unanimous judgment, without partiality or prejudice, in accordance with the ecclesiastical and apostolical rule, and to devise suitable remedies for the offenses which may have resulted from error, in order that the Church may be freed from all reproach, that my anxiety may be diminished, that peace may be restored to those now at variance, and that your renown may be increased. May God preserve you, beloved brethren. The bishops accordingly repaired to the Council of Tyre. Amongst them were those who were accused of holding heterodox doctrines, of whom Asclepius, bishop of Gaza, was one. The admirable Athanasius also attended. I shall first dwell on the tragedy of the accusation, and shall then relate the proceedings of this celebrated tribunal. Chapter 28. The Council of Tyre. Arsenius was a bishop of the Meletian faction. The men of his party put him in a place of concealment, and charged him to remain there as long as possible. They then cut off the right hand of a corpse, embalmed it, placed it in a wooden case, and carried it about everywhere, declaring that it was the hand of Arsenius, who had been murdered by Athanasius. But the Alcyonii did not permit Arsenius to remain long in concealment. He was first seen alive in Egypt, then in the Thebaid. Afterwards he was led by divine providence to Tyre, where the hand of tragic fame was brought before the council. The friends of Athanasius hunted him up, and brought him to an inn, where they compelled him to lay hid for a time. Early in the morning the great Athanasius came to the council. First of all a woman of lewd life was brought in, who deposed in a loud and impudent manner that she had vowed perpetual virginity, but that Athanasius, who had lodged in her house, had violated her chastity. After she had made her charge, the accused came forward, and with him a presbyter worthy of all praise, by name Timotheus. The court ordered Athanasius to reply to the indictment, but he was silent, as if he had not been Athanasius. Timotheus, however, addressed her thus: "Have I, O woman, ever conversed with you, or have I entered your house?" She replied with still greater effrontery, screaming aloud in her dispute with Timotheus, and, pointing at him with her finger, exclaimed, "It was you who robbed me of my virginity, it was you who stripped me of my chastity," adding other indelicate expressions which are used by shameless women. The devisers of this calumny were put to shame, and all the bishops, who were privy to it, blushed. The woman was now being led out of the court, but the great Athanasius protested that instead of sending her away they ought to examine her, and learn the name of the hatcher of the plot. Hereupon his accusers yelled, and shouted that he had perpetrated other viler crimes, of which it was utterly impossible that he could by any art or ingenuity be cleared, and that eyes, not ears, would decide on the evidence. Having said this, they exhibited the famous box, and exposed the embalmed hand to view. At this sight all the spectators uttered a loud cry. Some believed the accusation to be true, the others had no doubt of the falsehood, and thought that Arsenius was lurking somewhere or other in concealment. When at length, after some difficulty, a little silence was obtained, the accused asked his judges whether any of them knew Arsenius. Several of them replying that they knew him well, Athanasius gave orders that he should be brought before them. Then he again asked them, "Is this the right Arsenius? Is this the man I murdered? This the man those people mutilated after his murder, by cutting off his right hand?" When they had confessed that it was the same individual, Athanasius pulled off his cloak, and exhibited two hands, both the right and the left, and said, "Let no one seek for a third hand, for man has received two hands from the Creator, and no more." Even after this plain proof the calumniators, and the judges, who were privy to the crime, instead of hiding themselves, or praying that the earth might open and swallow them up, raised an uproar and commotion in the assembly, and declared that Athanasius was a sorcerer, and that he had by his magical incantations bewitched the eyes of men. The very men who a moment before had accused him of murder now strove to tear him in pieces, and to murder him. But those whom the emperor had entrusted with the preservation of order saved the life of Athanasius, by dragging him away, and hurrying him on board a ship. 1. When he appeared before the emperor, he described all the dramatic plot which had been got up to ruin him. The calumniators sent bishops attached to their faction into Merodis, Visi, Teoni, bishop of Nicaea, Theodorus, Bishop of Perinthus, Maris, Bishop of Charleston, Narcissus of Cilicia, too, with others of the same sentiments. Marotus is a district near Alexandria, and derives its name from the Lake Maria. 3. Here they invented other falsehoods, and, forging the reports of the trial, mixed up the charges which had been shown to be false with fresh accusations, as if they had been true, and dispatched them to the emperor. Chapter 29. Consecration of the Church of Jerusalem, Banishment of Saint Athanasius. All the bishops who were present at the Council of Tyre, with all others from every quarter, were commanded by the emperor to proceed to Aelia, 1, to consecrate the churches which he had there erected. The emperor dispatched also a number of officials of the most kindly disposition, remarkable for piety and fidelity, whom he ordered to furnish abundant supplies of provisions, not only to the bishops and their followers, but to the vast multitudes who flocked from all parts to Jerusalem. The holy altar was decorated with imperial hangings, and with golden vessels set with gems. When the splendid festival was concluded, each bishop returned to his own diocese. The emperor was highly gratified when informed of the splendor and magnificence of the function, and blessed the author of all good for having thus granted his petition. Athanasius having complained of his unjust condemnation, the emperor commanded the bishops against whom this complaint was directed to present themselves at court. Upon their arrival, they desisted from urging any of their former calumnies, because they knew how clearly they could be refuted, but they made it appear that Athanasius had threatened to prevent the exportation of corn. The emperor believed what they said, and banished him to a city of Gaul called Treves. 2. This occurred in the 30th year of the emperor's reign. 3. Chapter 30. Will of the Blessed Emperor Constantine. A year and a few months afterwards, 1. The emperor was taken ill at Nicomedia, a city of Bithynia, and, knowing the uncertainty of human life, he received the holy rite of baptism, 2, which he had intended to have deferred until he could be baptized in the river Jordan. He left as heirs of the imperial throne his three sons, Constantine, Constantius, and Constans, 3, the youngest. He ordered that the great Athanasius should return to Alexandria, and expressed this decision in the presence of Eusebius, who did all he could to dissuade him. Chapter 31. Apology for Constantine. It ought not to excite astonishment that Constantine was so far deceived as to send so many great men into exile, for he believed the assertions of bishops of high fame and reputation, who skillfully concealed their malice. Those who are acquainted with the sacred scriptures know that the holy David, although he was a prophet, was deceived, and that too not by a priest, but by one who was a menial, a slave, and a rascal. I mean Ziba, who deluded the king by lies against Mephibosheth, and thus obtained his land. 1. It is not to condemn the prophet that I thus speak, but that I may defend the emperor, by showing the weakness of human nature, and to teach that credit should not be given only to those who advance accusations, even though they may appear worthy of credit, but that the other party ought also to be heard, and that one ear should be left open to the accused.